This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio from the American Tobacco Historic District. The Yiddish language is a little over 1,000 years old, and even though it's been called a dying language, the number of Yiddish speakers around the world is actually growing. It developed among Jews who'd come to Germany from other parts of Europe. Its alphabet is largely Hebrew, but the words sound more like German, and over time it's found its way to every corner of the globe. Now, when most Americans think of Yiddish, they think music, in particular the popular songs of Fiddler on the Roof. But Yiddish music also sounds like this. This Sunday at Congregation Beth El in Durham, lovers of Yiddish music will gather together for a festival of songs, food, and goodwill. The evening's a benefit for Urban Ministries of Durham, and here to guide us through Yiddish and Yiddish music are Sheva Zucker, a Yiddish teacher and author of two Yiddish textbooks, as well as the editor of a 71-year-old Yiddish language magazine. And Jane Pepler's with us, a traditional music performer and teacher. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Sheva, tell us more about how the Yiddish language developed.
Okay, well, that was such a beautiful, succinct introduction. What can I add to that? Okay, so Jews were living in Germany on the banks of the Rhine. They had come there from France and Italy. And so the language really reflects the history and migrations of the Jews. There are still some elements of Old French and Italian. In Yiddish, the base of it is German, although, of course, people... There are disputing theories, but we won't get into that. And then as Jews moved eastward to Slavic territories, Poland, Russia, Ukraine, Lithuania, they absorbed words from those languages into their speech. And of course, a lot of Yiddish, possibly 30%, depending on who's speaking, actually comes from Hebrew, because the life of Jews was so different from the language of their co-territorial neighbors that they simply couldn't find the words that they needed, say, in the German language to describe all of the various rituals, customs, and so forth.
So the particulars of the particularly religious custom would remain in Hebrew, but then you start to adapt and the language starts to sound a little bit more like your neighbors.
Right. Although I think it started sounding like the neighbors. I mean, that's the base. And then just as Jews spoke, they had to take in Hebrew to describe their lives.
So That's 1,000 or so years ago. Mm-hmm. How is Yiddish doing today?
Well, that's an interesting question. Mark Twain once said, "The rumor of my death has been greatly exaggerated," and people have been saying that Yiddish is dying for years, whereas, as you mentioned, it's actually on the rise. So you have to have a kind of a – there are two separate worlds in the Jewish world, and it's definitely on the rise in the ultra-Orthodox communities, both in this country, Israel, wherever they might be, who, for example, in Israel, choose not to speak Hebrew because it's too holy to be spoken on an everyday basis, so they actually choose to speak Yiddish. So in those circles, because they have so many children, it's very much on the rise. However, in more liberal circles, shall we say, the typical Jew that you meet in Durham, North Carolina, probably has Yiddish-speaking grandparents, maybe even parents, but may not speak Yiddish. So that definitely it's in a crisis in the non-Orthodox world, but there are courses basically all over the world. There are young people studying Yiddish. It won't be like it was, but I think we're not in danger of losing it all.
And Jane Pepler, what drew you to playing the music, Yiddish music?
I heard it first in 1981. I think I heard the first concert of the New England Klezmer Conservatory Band when I was living up there. I loved the harmonies. I love the melodies. And I love the language. I thought it was beautiful. And I love its combination of tragedy and delight.
Let's listen right now to a Yiddish song by Arkady Gendler.
Mit a fiddle on a fiddle, wieder klingt a Yiddish Lidl, Mame loschen, siss da chame chaye. klezmer, einzig ich achum im Spiel, niedische Nigunim, zwischen alte Lieder spielt mir nahe. Chotsch auf jeder Schlange schwiegen, singen mir mit Fargenig, geh dabei ein Tänzel Molotow.
We have some of the music of our Katie Gendler, a Yiddish song. You can hear much more Sunday at a program called What's Not to Like at Bethel Congregation in Durham. But right now I have Sheva Zucker here and Jane Pepler to talk more about it. Was music always a part of the Yiddish tradition?
As far as I know.
And what distinguishes the music, Jane, when you play this? Because I know you play all kinds of different traditions. Does this feel to you, do you have to make big adjustments musically for this music? What's going on?
The nicest thing for me is that it is so unconstrained. When I play British Isles music, you have to be somewhat tasteful, and you can be less tasteful when you do. And you can just let it hang out more. Even though most of the tunes are identified as being in a minor key, they were called Freilachs. That doesn't mean that they're miserable songs. And you can just do more of everything when you do Yiddish music.
Sheva, the Jewish diaspora goes back way before 1,000 years. What is it about that particular migration to that section of Central Europe that do you think caused this particular language to grow and then prosper for so long?
Well, I guess there are two theories about how or why Yiddish developed, and one is that Jews were living a very insular life, and so they had to create their own language. But the one that I think is more accepted is that, in fact, Jews obviously had quite a bit of interaction with their non-Jewish neighbors, or they never would have been able to absorb the language. But at the same time, you might say there was interaction, but there was also a very separate life, which had its own customs and its own mores and rules and even law courts and what have you. So that's how it is. But I think in the last 150 years, there's just this incredible flowering of Yiddish literature that's almost unparalleled. I mean, hundreds of thousands of books were produced during this time. And that's really kind of just at this very interesting period where Jewish traditional life comes together with modern life.
When did it become a literature? When did Yiddish become a written language?
Oh, well, a written language, we have evidence of that probably going back to the 1200s. And probably that person who wrote that first piece of paper that is somewhere in the Oxford Museum didn't really have a sense that they were doing anything, that they were writing a new language. They thought they were writing German, but in Hebrew characters, because Jews weren't, this won't sound very progressive, but they weren't supposed to be writing in the non-Jewish language. The non-Jewish language was called Galchus, which is the language of the priests. And so clearly Jews didn't want to have anything to do with that. So they recorded their German message in Hebrew characters, and that's kind of how it went.
It's a little bit like writing. You mentioned Mark Twain a little earlier, and of course he was famous for having written in a vernacular. Now you can imagine if suddenly everybody wrote in their own vernacular that way, it becomes a literature, I guess, even though in a sense they're not intending to write a literature.
Okay. Those first things were really just letters, pieces of paper. And for a long time, I would say that Jews sort of eschewed a secular literature because that was nonsense. You should be spending your time studying the holy books. So Yiddish had to sort of contend with that as well. And the first literature it's not really the first, but when we kind of talk of the beginnings in the mid-18th century was generally considered to be for women, for servant girls, not for men who should be doing other things.
Other more important liturgical kinds of work. So Jane Pepler, tell us what we're going to see Sunday night and hear.
Well, I've known Gary Berman for a long time. He's a lawyer. He helped me buy my house in 1982, and he played piano for 14 years with the Triangle Jewish Chorale while I was the director, and he always did anything I asked him to without a complaint. And so now for his birthday, he's decided to have music that he chooses, and he arranges it, and he chooses the people who sing it, and he likes chamber music, and so it's going to have kind of a chamber music sound. It's got two violins, a viola, digamba and a piano accompanying it. And he's chosen the music with Sheva's help and some other people's, and he's got a lot of people singing, and I think it's just marvelous. Nobody else is doing this that I've ever heard of.
And where is the music found today? Is it written tradition? Is it played all over the world as well?
It's in books. There's lots of people collecting music from living people, or there are people that are trying to remember songs from their grandmothers. They're just kind of scraping them up from whatever corner they can find. There are a tremendous number of albums, even from the very beginning of the 1900s, that were recorded in Europe of Yiddish music.
It's going to be a great evening. And, of course, the proceeds then go to help urban ministries who help people without shelter in the Durham area. So it's going to be a great night, huh? Where can we get tickets?
You can get tickets at YiddishSongFest@AOL.com or by calling the Burmans at 682-7468.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Sheva Zucker is a Yiddish teacher and the author of two Yiddish textbooks. Jane Pepler is a traditional music performer and teacher. She's going to be singing this Sunday at What's Not to Like, a Yiddish Song Fest. The event takes place at Congregation Bethel in Durham. Starts at 7:30. Proceeds go to Urban Ministries of Durham. And for more information about them, you can go to umdurham.org. Just ahead, how mining for mercury and silver in the Andes helped build our global economy and ruin local community. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us.